Welcome to A Call to Lead at LifeScience.org, where we explore the leadership journeys of life science entrepreneurs. I'm David Kirk, and in each episode, I sit down with a life science leader to uncover the moments that define their leadership. My guest this week
is Jack O'Mara, a CEO of Airska, an RNA medicines company focused on the brain and CNS diseases. And I am based in Dublin, but we have a research site in what we've branded Greater London, but Stevenage. So a little bit outside London.
We're grateful at LifeScience.org to have a community of over 400 life science CEOs, leaders driving change in biotech, medtech, tech bio, and healthcare. The conversations inside our community, stories of conviction, navigating challenges, and making bold decisions inspire us every week. And now we are sharing them with the world. Jack, it is great to have you on the podcast on A Call to Lead.
Thanks for having me, Dave. Great to be here. This is we did one of these a few years ago, so excited to be back on.
And I was just going through your very long CV, and some of the highlights that I picked out is that you co-founded a group placing Irish graduates in Silicon Valley startups at one point.
Long time ago now. Yeah, that was the first venture, first foray into startup entrepreneurship. But a lot of fun.
Anything for Ireland.
Flying the flag.
I'm biased. And you've also consulted with AveXis / Novartis Gene Therapeutics when they were acquired on the Zolgensma project, which is really cool.
Yeah, that was a really inspiring program to be a part of, and a small part, but it was got me hooked on biotech. And yeah, glad to dive into that one if it's of interest.
Yeah. And of course, this isn't your first venture now. You were CEO and co-founder of Ochre Bio. And this kind of leads me on to the big question of this podcast, which is, what called you to lead?
What called me to lead? Yes, great. It's a great question. And I think we probably all have individual calls or motives. I guess for me, I am very driven by trying to enact the change one wants to see in the world, trying to change the things we can, and have always been interested in healthcare and some of the big problems of healthcare. And I was more, my leadership grew out of my desire to solve a problem rather than deciding I wanted to be a leader, I guess, in a way. I had seen some of the exciting progress that AveXis had pioneered in the US after living over there for a few years early in my career, and was just amazed by what a small group of people with a big vision and sort of a clear focus can achieve. And they were very focused on a rare neuromuscular disease called SMA, and seeing, again, what amazing results that whole team pioneered for that group and that patient community really inspired me to try and take some of that entrepreneurial energy and sort of ambition and vision back to my homeland, the motherland, Europe, but more specifically Ireland. And then I got into entrepreneurship through a sort of happen chance meeting with a scientist with a clear vision for liver disease. And that got me quite hooked on, wow, could we really solve what is one of the big chronic diseases of the day, chronic liver disease, after spending 5 years building that one, taking it out, pulling it out of the earth, giving it life, and growing as a leader through that whole process. I'm excited to get back on the horse and try it again in brain, and hopefully make a meaningful impact for those suffering from chronic neurological conditions, which is only has a personal resonance for me. And yeah, hopefully that answers your question in maybe a roundabout way.
I think there's always some personal story when it comes to leadership, and maybe this is why you've chosen to do it again. You just touched on it there. What's the personal connection that's inspiring you to go forward?
Like many others, I've lived up close and personal to the trials and profound tragedy that is Alzheimer's. When I was a young man, I was quite close with my beloved grandmother, who subsequently passed to Alzheimer's disease. But it's kind of as particularly something to watch up close and personal as a young person. It's a pretty profoundly tragic condition in that you sort of slowly lose someone way before you lose them. They say you lose them twice, to the disease and ultimately to passing. And I think, like I'm sure many others, that left a pretty deep mark. And I had tried to, before Okra, I don't think it's on that list of things I worked on, had tried to start a neurologic or chronic neurodegenerative disease focused company pre-Okra, which was more of a palliative treatment, more in the digital health space for Alzheimer's disease caregivers, people who are tending to those that have unfortunately succumbed to the disease. So I'd always been sort of personally motivated to try and solve or have a make a contribution to the to this you know, health challenge that plagues so many people around the world. And then having had the great experience with Okra over the last 5 years and, you know, learning so much along that journey, thought, and also just given how the technology of RNA is evolving and some of the progress in delivery, thought, wow, could we really maybe have a go at some of these bigger brain diseases using a similar technology advance around RNA medicine? And so I found myself leading again, maybe not through the intent of leadership, but through the intent of solving a problem and then trying to build a group of people who are equally as motivated as I am to try and solve that problem. And as you say, leading them to do that and hopefully make a big impact on the world.
I think what you've just described as leading these people to solve a problem is very much leadership. Going back to maybe Okra is the example, but of course, you know your story better than I do. What do you think was the biggest personal challenge that you faced on your leadership journey, or maybe the most difficult decision you had to make as a leader early on?
Yeah, I guess my journey is maybe a little bit different than the traditional. When I took the helm or when I helped to co-found Okra, I was relatively early in my career. And that poses, I think, a few clear challenges in the biotechnology space, an industry where basically our whole job is to try and minimize and control risk as we shepherd innovation through the clinical phases and ultimately to impacted patients at the end of that long road. So there doesn't tend to be an appetite to take on management risk in these companies, and inherently, you know, by nature of being relatively early career, there is a sort of a just by de facto a less experience than a more someone who's been in the industry for 20 years. So I think I had to learn a lot, both across the drug discovery continuum, as well as the leadership and fundraising and all of the things it takes to make a biotechnology company successful. And I think maybe one of the key transitions that I went through on that journey was this idea of a leader. I guess I had thought about myself more as a entrepreneur or a founder when I started that company. And over the first several years, I quickly began to realize that. This might sound like semantics, like a kind of a dumb thing to say, but I found myself realizing that leadership and effective leadership is really key to success in any organization, but particularly in science, where there's so much that's unknown and maybe, you know, so much bravo, or, you know, it's a industry where we don't know the right answer for sometimes decades, and so sometimes the person or the people with the strongest opinions are the ones that win out. So I think in this particular industry, maybe even more than others, it requires like a very balanced, considered and intentional leadership to sort of corral a group of hyper intellectual people around sort of a singular path forward and ultimately deliver on a product innovation that could go on to make a big impact for patients. So I guess maybe it's a bit, it doesn't maybe sound as lofty, but I guess when I started the company, I very much thought to myself, okay, it's entrepreneur. We're going to get going and build a team and it's all going to come together. And then slowly over the years there, it needs like a single point of definitive strategy, decision-making, capacity to build alliances, capacity to bring people together, capacity to break down silos, capacity to get ahead of sort of organizational dysfunction or kind of personality issues along the way. And so, I don't know, all that to say, I think it was a bit of a, there's a lot of learnings in that journey that got me to where we are today.
Yeah, it sounds like the universal challenge for first-time founders, first-time CEOs.
I think it's probably a very different role than most others in that there's so many different stakeholders you're balancing. You know, you gotta have a keen eye on the market and how the market is moving and responding to your particular domain of focus. You've got hyper capable scientific teams and commercial teams and clinical teams and all these internal stakeholders you have to balance. And then you got to know like when is the right time for the right investment or like capital allocation around, do we need to do more discovery or is the market telling us that that's not the right investment at this point? How do we know we have something that's really ready for prime time? And when to make those kind of changes in transitions for the company? There's a lot to the role that a first time CEO has to sort of grapple with. And that's why you got great mentors and advisors, and that's why you got a great community like Life Science Org, where people can kind of share some of their lessons learned along the way in this sort of amorphous road of biotech entrepreneurship. And very grateful for that.
Yeah, obviously we're very big on peer-to-peer learning in Life Science Org. Like listening to other CEOs like yourself, maybe they're on their second or third venture, they're leading in Europe. What challenges do you think you share with them the most?
In Europe specifically, I guess. Maybe being in Europe is the one. So much of the capital base for these high risk, high reward companies, which is innate to therapeutic development, it originates or kind of sits in the US. I hope that we'll start to see some change in Europe with respect to the scale and the quantum of capital. And it's starting to sort of suggest that we might, but you do have to keep a keen eye on relationship building towards those US funders, even personnel and talent and sort of ultimately the road to the market, which is where, again, the US sort of ultimately ends up being for most of these companies. So with peers in Europe, I think it's maybe that challenge of like, how do you build a bridge to your ultimate market and to your likely ultimate capital base, while always running a company here in Europe and building great teams and trying to cultivate the next generation of leaders and try to build a culture that's cohesive and focused and all of the regular challenges. But maybe there's sort of a unique additional dimension when you're talking about European founders.
Yeah, and I think you've touched on something very important there, which is that almost that bridge across the Atlantic. You want to build that. And I remember the first time we spoke when you were a CEO of Ocker, it was kind of on the back of you had done a great fundraise with Ocker, but you had made those connections through not a podcast. I can't even remember the name of the platform. They can tell how it's fallen out of favor. But that was, I think, during COVID, wasn't it? Tell me about that.
A long time ago now, yeah. So much of Ocker was during COVID, which is an interesting experience in its own right. But I tend to sort of skew on the more non-traditional creative side of the curve. And one of the things I did during COVID with a view to trying to build those inroads and relationships was set up a weekly meeting on a platform called Clubhouse, which is, for anyone who remembers, it was sort of like dial-in radio when everyone was locked in our houses and miserable and bored. We all were craving social connection. It served as a nice, medium to convene biotechnology people from around the world. And we hosted sort of open discussion and kind of an interview with an entrepreneur and hear their story, and then sort of a forum for discussion with the wider community. You just get like 200 or 300 people joining every Sunday for this this event, and which is lovely, and it really was a really like a global community. And I still meet people who I haven't never actually seen in person or I connected with over that platform. I went for dinner recently with a guy called Richard Wilson, who's based out of San Francisco with Astellas, and he and I had connected over that, and we built a really great relationship over the last couple of years. And so, yeah, it was just a lovely platform to try and bring people together, and in a non-traditional way, sort of open up relationships or doors to people that you wouldn't have otherwise. And it actually ended up finding someone who co-led our Series A at Ocker, who called me up after saying he'd been doing his laundry and listening to my talk on a Sunday and was super interested to learn more. And that relationship went on to be a co-lead of our Series A. So it just kind of shows you like it's, entrepreneurship is a lot about building bridges between yourself, potential hires, potential investors, potential partners, and finding creative ways to do that can be powerful.
Yeah, that's a great story. And it's a shame Clubhouse, I think as soon as COVID was over, it just died a death, unfortunate, but it goes to show the power of networking. You mentioned as well with Ocker, that first time being a CEO, You had lots of mentors and advisors. I'd love to know, what valuable lesson did you learn from maybe a peer or a colleague that no formal education could have taught you?
I think probably the most valuable lesson, and I don't know who I picked it up from, but is just the importance of context. That sounds obvious, but so many decisions that one has to make in a leadership role in a biotech are on the hair, and having a little touch more context as to your situation, the partner situation, the other stakeholders can shift the needle between left and right and can really dramatically change the outcome. And it's so tempting, clearly the first-time entrepreneur, to listen to the sage advice of peers and colleagues or people who've done it before, but you are in the driving seat and you have the most context with respect to every individual decision. It's typically you do. And that context is the most important thing. And you really need to take the advice, but then apply it in a very focused way within the context of the decision that you're about to make. And that's, I think, maybe sometimes underappreciated. There's no easy slap, you know, there's no obvious right or wrong in these companies. They're all so individual and unique. They're all snowflakes in their own right. And so really understanding that and trying to figure out what's the best decision within your specific snowflake is the key.
Yeah. Context is king is a phrase I quite enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
I think context applies here.
Yeah.
Before we talk about AirSCA in a bit more detail, I'd love to know, what do you find particularly exciting about European life science today?
A few things. I think, you know, we've got the kind of old, tired sayings that we revert back to, but, you know, great science. I mean, it's a common theme, but it is still true. We have phenomenal early research and capabilities in Europe. And now an emerging sort of repeat scale-up entrepreneurial class of talent, which is great for the ecosystem, i.e. people who have been in growth companies, been a part of growth companies, seen companies taken from zero to one, as it were, into kind of scaled biotech companies. There is a very different way of thinking in a biotech environment than in a large pharma environment, and having people kind of cycle through that education and more, you know, over the last 5+ years now, or, you know, that is ultimately a very big net positive for the ecosystem. You start to see some maturity in the executive teams of these biotech companies. There is an inherent sophisticated large pharma base in Europe. It's probably the only remaining major industry where Europe still has a very strong leading foothold in, versus tech or other, where Europe has been slowly kind of left behind to a degree, maybe not entirely true, but life sciences, we still are a very competitive global force to be reckoned with. And there is an amazing training ground for late stage growth talent in those companies, which if we can find ways to draw into the startup world or the biotech world in a more, with a higher throughput, that could be a very positive thing. And what I, the last one is just a bit more risk capital appetite, I think, is starting to come through with things like the Mansion House reforms in the UK. The Irish Sovereign Wealth Fund has been quite intentional about investing in early stage companies. There seems to be some larger pools of capital that are beginning to become unlocked for early stage innovation. And if you can match the talent, the kind of long-term research and pharma base with that risk on capital, then I think you have sort of the key ingredients for a real growth trajectory. And there is a lot of pharma now leaving UK in particular, and bringing some of that research back to the US, but that leaves behind a pool of high quality, high trained talent as well. And if you can match that with this sort of entrepreneurial energy and risk on capital, you could start to see a real flourishing of early stage life sciences companies. And that would be a tremendous thing for Europe and the UK for sure.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier on that AirSCA is based in Dublin and in London. What are the advantages to that? And was Brexit a factor in that decision making?
Well, I can put the latter to bed pretty quickly and say no. Although we have had some more challenges with immigration and in the UK of late, which is suboptimal, maybe starts to raise some concerns. But no, The primary reason was that there's great talent bases in both geographies. In London, you've got this amazing discovery biology capability, and that's what the UK has been known for and continues to be a real global leader in. And we wanted to be in that geography to get access to that high quality talent. I mentioned earlier that some of the large pharma companies were shutting down research departments, particularly in the neuro space. So we moved pretty quickly to bring in some of the leadership from those groups and to build out early discovery biology bases in London to kind of take advantage of that available talent base. And then in Ireland, you do have great development capabilities, great corporate people. There's sort of a strong, there's an emerging ecosystem there as well. And it's like a 40-minute flight between the two sites. And yeah, that's kind of it's an easy sort of dual location to pull on. There's also a lot of public funding in Ireland that's looking for ways to support the indigenous entrepreneurship ecosystem here in light of maybe an economy that was overly reliant on foreign direct investment for the last 20, 30, 40 years and is now more incentivized than ever to really start to think about how do we build indigenous growth companies. And so we're kind of availing and working with the local bodies to seek sort of public funding support for some of the research activities here as well. It's mostly sort of clinical development, CMC scale up, which is a big part of the modality that we're working on, antibody oligoconjugates. And so, yeah, we're excited to do some of that work in Ireland.
As a leader, you've chosen to address this particular area. You've kind of touched on the personal motivations. Why? But tell me more about the challenge, what it means for patients, and why you chose to pursue this area.
Yeah, that's a lovely question, Dave. Thanks so much. I guess maybe the first thing to say is RNA-based medicines, probably underappreciated quite how successful they've been. And this was sort of part of the founding thinking behind Okra all those many moons ago, was just how GalNAc, which is a sugar that's used to deliver siRNAs to the liver, had sort of unlocked delivery to the liver. And if you can deliver these medicines, they're actually very effective when they get to the tissue of interest. So we've seen just some amazing medicines come to life over the last decade or so in liver and cardiometabolic related indications. Things like Leqvio or inclisiran, the PCSK9 biannual, GalNAc siRNA for PCSK9. It's been a tremendous success. There's a whole host of others around ATTR and otherwise. And I guess what that's proven is that if you can get or siRNA medicine to the tissue you're interested in, you can have pretty elegant both dosing regimen, pharmacology, safety, because these are quite specific and they tend to knock down a single gene, and you can very precisely design them to knock down a single gene of interest. If there's pharmacology behind that gene, then you'll see a clinical benefit. So our premise when starting this company was, look what siRNAs have done for liver and cardiometabolic disease. Look at the progress in delivery to the brain using the various receptors on the blood-brain barrier that have been co-opted for transporting biologics across the BBB. If we could find a way to deliver siRNAs efficiently to the brain and in a systemically administered way, maybe even like a subcutaneous jab, wouldn't that just open up a whole world of innovation for neurological conditions? Mm-hmm. Alzheimer's being one of a variety of diseases that suffer from an overproduction of a misbehaving protein, and siRNAs are very effective at turning off overactive genes or malevolent proteins. So as a result, that was sort of the genesis. And as we begin to build out this, what's called an antibody oligo conjugate platform, it's basically your oligo is your siRNA and your antibody is like your homing missile or your homing device that gets it to the brain, and the conjugate being the way you put those two things together. If you can do that, you can very quickly build up a portfolio of different siRNAs targeting different genes and then use the same sort of homing device to get them into the brain. And then you can start to build a portfolio of impactful medicines for CNS diseases. And that's very much what the strategy of Erska is to go and do.
For those listening, you didn't get to see Jack waving his hands about wildly as he described
There's a lot of hand gestures in that one.
It was a great visual metaphor for it, though, because this is the big question. How do you get your silencing RNA to the point of action. And it's an interesting approach. What I'd like to ask you next is, what can we do about these challenges, not just with your indication in neurological diseases, but even the RNA medicine modality? What can we in the ecosystem do about these challenges? And what does the world look like if we're successful?
Oh, I love that one. Okay, I'll start with the latter because it's a big vision, and then I'll sort of talk about what we in the ecosystem can do. I mean, our big vision, like the thing we started this company around, and it's sort of probably a 10, maybe 20 year vision. So, you know, we keep that in mind, but is like prevention, you know, it with the safety profile and the convenience factor of systemic administration of, you know, like what Leqvio has proven with PCSK9 is you can get like a biannual jab and keep your cholesterol under control. That's pretty badass. That's like a prevention, like akin to what a statin has done, but almost in a preventative setting. What about doing that for neurological conditions? Like, we know, not nailed on, but there are some fairly well validated targets now and sort of these big CNS diseases. And what about like an early intervention that's administered to a family history or genetic predisposition or some reason that elevates your risk profile for Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or any of these sort of, or Huntington's, or these sort of complex chronic conditions? And what about then thinking about catching those patients early enough in the disease? You don't have to reverse a whole load of pathology and a whole lot of plaque and neuronal death and all the challenges that come with these chronic diseases, but just prevent it. Just dose it early enough in the disease journey so that you just turn off the tap of the misbehaving protein using siRNA, and then you slow the progression. And how do you do that is the question. How do you think of a clever clinical strategies and ways to be able to show that your medicine is actually successful in preventing without a 20-year-long clinical trial that breaks the bank and no one will fund? So those are some of the things that I get excited about when I think about this type of RNA in the brain and kind of just the direction of travel for medicine. Because it's like anything, you know, stitch in time saves nine. If the disease is very far advanced, it's so hard to reverse it, but particularly chronic diseases, because it's slow and progressive and just damage, you know, it's buildup of consistent damage. If you can get in early and prevent or slow the worsening of the disease, you'll probably have a much higher clinical benefit for patients. Patients will be healthier for longer, avoid symptoms and the horrible manifestations of these diseases. Anyway, get off my soapbox. That's the kind of vision. On the practical side, I think maybe one thing that we as an ecosystem, particularly in the life sciences world, need to be kind of cognizant and intentional about is what we've seen with the massive backlash to mRNA in the US. It hasn't quite come to Europe yet. Hopefully it won't anytime soon. But, you know, this like unscientific, seemingly kind of random backlash to a promising new medical innovation spurred by online sort of rhetoric that sometimes there's some merit to, right? Like, you know, it's always a risk benefit with these types of innovations too, but oftentimes is not driven by any scientific fact. It's driven by opinion. And that's where we need to be super vigilant and intentional as leaders in the life sciences world to educate and to be accessible and not on our high horse or not use language that is inaccessible to the average punter, you know, to try and communicate our mission and communicate what we're trying to do and why we think it's the right thing for the patient, for society. Because if we don't do that, people will do it for us. And oftentimes those people who do it for us don't have our best interests at heart. One of our or society's best interests at heart, for that matter. So I think that's something as a community we will all need to be vigilant about and, you know, deal with it pretty head on and not shy away when it happens. But yeah, that's my two cents.
No, I think that's a wonderful point, especially with the recent developments in the world since the pandemic, but it's been rearing its head even before that.
Yeah.
Finally, Jack, the last thing I want to ask you, our podcast is called A Call to Lead. You've shared some very interesting stories with me, and I want to thank you for your time. You literally hopped off a plane and spoke to me, which is amazing. Thank you so much. Is there anything on the leadership journey that we haven't talked about that you would like to talk about in your final few minutes?
Good question. I think maybe the only thing to say is just there is, in any sort of biotech environment, there is so much ambiguity and so much unknown, and you can kind of get paralyzed by indecision as much as anything else. And trying to, your role as a leader is when challenged or faced with a variety of choices in a difficult time, is to do the assessment and make the call and then move and get the thing done. That's maybe the difference between, it is very easy to be tempted into, let's overanalyze everything, and let's, when you don't have the time to do that. So I guess maybe that decision orientation is another important part of leadership that we didn't discuss in much detail. But I don't think there's much else that we need to cover. Yeah, I really enjoyed the conversation, and thanks so much for having me. It's been many moons since we last talked these things through, but yeah, I really enjoyed catching up and sharing a little bit more on the learnings.
Thank you so much for your time today, Jack. I really appreciate it. And hopefully your lessons learned, your stories will resonate across the community of life science leaders.
Thank you very much, Dave, as ever. Until next time, Company 3.
Everybody knows that Europe is a global leader in generating translational science. We also have world-class leadership talent. To hear the stories, lessons, and experiences of our science leaders, listen to A Call to Lead at LifeScience.org, available on all good podcasting platforms.